in verse 18 in a moment. When you study the book of Genesis, there are plenty of stories of faithful men and women. There are also some stories that are quite wicked. What we're going to be looking at in chapter 34 tonight is definitely one of those stories. As you go through the book of Genesis, there's several stories. We've already covered one of them where sexual sin really brings about great difficulty. Back in Genesis chapter 19, the story of Lot and his two daughters who have escaped from Sodom and Gomorrah, and they decide that the daughters will get Lot drunk so that they can become pregnant by their own father. A very evil story in terms of incest in such a evil way. Tonight's story that we're going to see in chapter 34 is literally a story of rape. There is nothing to defend about it. There is nothing to say that is consoling in terms of that. And to understand in looking at these things, I know they're very tender topics, and that's how we're going to deal with them. And I hope you'll be mindful of that in your comments and anything that you bring up. As the book of Genesis continues on, even in Genesis 35, verse 22, there's a story of Reuben about him being intimate with his father's wife or maid in terms of Bilhah. And because of that, over in Genesis 49, Reuben's blessing is going to be taken back. You notice these things always come with grave consequences. And of course, later on, even in Genesis 38, there's coming a story with Judah about the lineage that Jesus is going to come through with his unfaithfulness in what happens with Tamar, his daughter-in-law, twice over, and his unfaithfulness in that, and to see the own shame that he brings upon himself. And so as you see these things together, understand there's a point to this. It's not just to bring up horrible stories. It's to see that you can see these things in Genesis and go, it's time to heed the warning and to make sure that we don't step in those same paths, because they will rip and tear apart our lives in a similar way as what it did for them. And yet, these kind of stories in Genesis are not in every chapter, and we're grateful for that. And yet the ones that are present are ones that should be considered wholeheartedly. They are not in there as just a filler. They are to truly be considered. If you look at Genesis chapter 33, look at verse 18. It says, now Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, and that's where this story is going to take place in chapter 34, is in the city of Shechem from what it seems contextually. He says, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram, remember way up north of the Euphrates River, and camped before the city. He, talking about Jacob, bought the piece of land where he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. So he buys this land. Later on, if you're reading in John chapter 4, this is going to be the same place called Sychar in the New Testament. Here it is. Then verse 20, then he, talking about Jacob, erected there an altar and called it El Elohi Israel, God my God, or God the God of Israel. And if you remember, this is very monumental in the life of Jacob, whose name has really just been changed to Israel, but he's still going to be referred to as Jacob along the way in the rest of the book of Genesis. So now you see Jacob saying, God is my God. He is the God of me. He is the God of Israel. And so, and you'll notice as we go through chapter 34, the first time that Israel is referred to as a nation, as opposed to just an individual. We'll see that come up kind of in passing. Chapter 34 opens up this way. It says, now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. Now remember, the name Dinah means judge or vindication or vindicated. keep that in mind, because you're going to see some vindication tonight as things continue forward. If you look at this story, and of course, there were other daughters of Jacob. Dinah's the only one we know by name. And because of chapter 34 is probably the reason why, that you actually have a name associated with her. In seeing this, you see where Dinah is, daughter of Leah, daughter of Jacob. And notice, what is she basically going out to do? She just wants to go out and visit the daughters of the land. She wants to, we would say in our own kind of vernacular, she wants to go out and meet the neighbors. And so remember, they've been up in Paddan Aram for all of her life until this travel back home. And so now it's time to go and meet people. Verse 2. When Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her. The last two words are very important. By force. This is not something consensual. Do not make that mistake. Something else I want you to notice here. It says, when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite. Now, you may not remember the Hivites, but we've talked about them before back in Genesis chapter 10. When it was just after the times of the flood, and of course, with Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Ham, being the son of Noah, has a son by the name of Canaan. And Canaan's descendants, some of them will become the Hivites. So understand, there was a curse upon the people of Ham, and that they would be have this land taken away from them, which we know of as the Promised Land. They would be the inhabitants after the flood. Then later on, the descendants who came through the promise were going to basically take them out of the land. So here's some of those people. Here's Shechem. And Shechem literally means personal interest. And I think you'll understand why that's the meaning of that name. Very fitting. So when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land. So you can kind of imagine here that Hamor would be seen as the king, his son Shechem being the prince of the land of where they live. And remember, the town is named after Shechem himself, who is still a young man relatively. And so he sees Dinah and he takes her and he lays with her and he takes her by force. And probably in our present day terminology, we would say rape. And I think that's very fitting here in terms of terminology, not in terms of action. Then verse 3, he was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. Doesn't this just sound like a mixed up young man? Now, here's another aspect of this. If you remember, Dinah's aunt is a woman by the name of Rachel. So sometimes you might see a niece or a nephew and go, oh, you remind me a lot of your aunt or your uncle. It seems like she was very beautiful in some sense, at least to Shechem. And you see what's at hand here. And so Shechem is very attracted to Dinah. Doesn't really tell you necessarily much more than that. Doesn't need to. But notice the way he talks about it. And he loved the girl. If you stop and take that in, if you really love somebody, don't you really want to do what's honorable? Shouldn't it change your actions towards somebody? There are a lot of young men and women who say they love one another, but they don't keep themselves pure and realize genuine love wants to go after purity in every aspect of life, here especially dealing with the intimate side. He says, and he spoke tenderly to her. And so you notice, here is this type of relation. Here's the prince of the land. This is probably not the story that young girls think of becoming the princess. But here he is as the prince of the land, and he speaks tenderly to her. He loves her, yet notice he's not one of the faithful men of Genesis. And you can tell that even by his actions. Then, as it continues on, verse 4, It comes to this next aspect here, and you may be thinking, does anyone care about Dinah? Will there be any justice? Her name does mean vindication. She will not be the one who takes out any vindication. But notice how it continues. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get me the young girl for a wife. Remember, this is the times of arranged type marriages. He loves the girl. He's taken her by force, evilness. And yet he's still speaking tenderly to her. And so he goes to his father, who I'm going to presume to be the king since he's a prince, and says, that's the girl I want to marry. Get her for me. Verse 5. Now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now remember, Jacob is not at least 97 years old. So you might look at this story and go, how come he's not doing something about this? Well, when you're 97, it changes a little bit. Now granted, he's going to live to be 180. So, but notice this. Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob kept silent until they came in. He hears word of this, which is quite something. But he's silent until what point? Till his sons come back in, because they're out there tending to the livestock. Then, notice how it continues into verse 6. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Now, here's Hamor. I'm not sure how familiar Hamor is with the situation. Sometimes fathers are the last ones to know. But whatever that may be, he's going off and saying, my son wants to marry your daughter. I'm here to come and speak to you about this. So he goes out to Jacob to speak with him. Verse 7. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it. When they heard it. You know what they're hearing. And notice what it makes, it draws up with inside of them. It's not time to stay out in the field with livestock anymore. It's time to come into town. It's time to go back home. And then it tells you about what's going on the inside. The very first aspect is, they are grieved. And I hope tonight we're not drawing up any memories for people. But to know that these kind of things take place for family members does cause a great grief. I mean a terrible grief. You don't want that to happen to anybody. But you sure don't want it to happen to your family. After grief, what happens next? What are they also feeling? Not just angry, they are very angry. And you can understand why. I mean, this is their sister. This is a sister they love. And especially for six of them, this is a full-blooded sister. Then you notice the next thing. He says they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel. And disgraceful, you may think, is putting it very lightly, but that's exactly what this is. This is completely disgraceful. And here's this statement, disgraceful thing in Israel. For the first time, the descendants of Jacob are referred to as a nation of people in Israel. Then he says, by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. He says, this should never be the way that things happen. And I want you to see that Scripture is making that plain and clear. It is not just telling you this story as if this is just another event that happened. It's saying, this is the picture of what not to ever do. And in seeing that, you get an idea here about what's going on. Then, I want you to consider this even perhaps a step further. He says, it shouldn't be done. And remember, Genesis is written to a people who have just come out of captivity in Egypt. And they're in the wilderness and they're about to be given the law. And in years down the road, they're going to be even be given the book of Deuteronomy. And I want to show you the principles that are going to be in place so that these type of things don't take place anymore. Look over at Deuteronomy chapter 22. Deuteronomy chapter 22. Verses 13 through 21 are really about purity in terms of within the young men and women of Israel. I will read through them so that you see the point, but we're not going to dally on them very long. Deuteronomy 22, verse 13. If any man takes a wife and goes into her, in other words, they're married, he says, and then turns against her and charges her with shameful deeds and publicly defames her and says, I took this woman, but when I came near her, I did not find her a virgin. He says, I thought I was marrying someone who was pure, but now I've discovered that she was not pure. Or you'll notice what happens next, verse 15. Then the girl's father and her mother shall take and bring out the evidence of the girl's virginity to the elders of the city at the gate. I'm assuming this is the bed linens of the honeymoon, in my mind. If you want to go in a different direction, that's fine. Then, here's the proof. Then, he says, bring it to the elders of the city at the gate, verse 16. The girl's father shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man for a wife, but he turned against her. She was pure whenever he married her. He's saying, this is a situation where this is him, this is not her. He's the one who's changed his mind and bringing up these false charges. He says, and behold, he has charged her with shameful deeds, saying, I did not find your daughter a virgin, but this is the evidence of my daughter's virginity, and they shall spread the garment before the elders of the city. Time for the elders to make a judgment. Verse 18. So the elders of that city shall take the man and chastise him. They're going to discipline him because he made up these false charges, because she was pure. Then, verse 19, and they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give it to the girl's father because he publicly defamed a virgin of Israel, and she shall remain his wife. He cannot divorce her all his days. He says, if you're thinking of shaming someone who's pure whenever you were married, he says, you better think secondly about it. Because if you're just going to make this stuff up, guess what? She's going to be yours every day the rest of your life. What does that tell you about what God thinks about purity? Does he value it? Is he going to defend it? Then here comes the flip side. But if this charge is true, that the girl was not found a virgin, then they shall bring out the girl to the doorway of her father's house. And the men of her city shall stone her to death because she has committed an act of folly in Israel by playing the harlot in her father's house. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. What precedent was God setting? I demand purity. You look at those kind of things, and there are times I go, there's an aspect of, I wish we took it that serious. I wish we really did. Because we really need to as God's people. Now, at the same time, I'm also thankful for the grace of God under the new covenant. Because there is forgiveness available. And we need to remember that too. Then, verse 22. Different situation. If a man is found lying with a married woman, not his wife, by the way, then both of them shall die, the man who lay with the woman and the woman. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. It says, here they are, both caught in the very act. And what should be the outcome? Death of both the man and the woman. Now, there's a man with a married woman. He says, you shall purge the evil from Israel. You think that would change people's thinking? If you were thinking something a little disturbing or perverted, and all of a sudden you see this happen, are you going to go, you know what, I need to change my mind. I need to change my heart. Then we get into another different situation. Verse 23. If there is a girl who is a virgin engaged to a man, and another man finds her in the city. Now, in the city is the important phrase. Here in a minute we're going to see in the field. and it's going to be different. He says, if there is a girl who's a virgin engaged to a man, so she's already engaged, and another man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death. The girl, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man, because he has violated his neighbor's wife. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. The statement is about if you're in the city and you were the woman, what were you supposed to do? You better cry out. And if you were in the city and you heard a cry, what ought you be doing? You better run and help. But if there's no cry, that tells you a little something. She's involved in this. And the outcome for both of them? Stoned to death. It says, because she didn't cry out and because he violated his neighbor's wife. Then, verse 25. He says, but if in the field, now that's a different situation. But if in the field the man finds the girl who is engaged and the man forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lies with her shall die. Only the man's held accountable. And it's going to give you the reason why. Verse 26. But you shall do nothing to the girl. There is no sin in the girl worthy of death. For just as a man rises against his neighbor and murders him, so is this case. When he found her in the field, the engaged girl cried out, but there was no one to save her. He says, that's why she's not found guilty. Because if she cried out with everything she had, and there was no one to save her. But to go, what's going to happen to that man? He will not be a problem to her ever again. He will be stoned to death. Once again, what do you see God setting up the boundary for? Purity. I demand purity. And ironically, he demands purity. Who is that good for? Everybody. Everybody who wants to do good. So you see the picture here, and that's probably where we might want to plug in the story that we've been reading in Genesis. But I want you to see something else here. Keep in mind, Genesis is not under this old covenant. But see what was going to happen later on. Notice how this continues, verse 28. If a man finds a girl who is a virgin who is not engaged, we don't really know whether Dinah was engaged or not. It doesn't ever give us any insight, so it's not quite sure where that story would fit. But if a man finds a girl who is a virgin who is not engaged and seizes her and lies with her and they are discovered, then the man who lay with her shall give to the girl's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall become his wife, because he has violated her. He cannot divorce her all his days. What does that tell you? If you're not going to be pure, then what did God demand under the old covenant? You're going to be married to her all your days. You can never put her away. Because you took something from her that only one person could. Now, you see these pictures, and the reason that I wanted to go through here is to see, these things are about lifetime commitments. And to understand to see where God stood on these things. He was not one who was like, you know, it's okay. I don't think you could ever come to that conclusion after reading through these verses. Unless you're just not reading and hearing. Come back over to Genesis chapter 34. So you understand here in verse 7, when it's talked about this disgraceful thing, very angry, grieved. These kind of things ought not to be done. Disgraceful thing in Israel. Verse 8. But Hamor spoke with them. Now, I think you can already fill in the blank with who them is. Talking about Jacob and Dinah's brothers. So, he says, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage. You go, it's interesting. That's how he describes it. He says, boy, he is really in love with your daughter. I mean, his soul longs to be with her. He says, please give her to him in marriage. And remember, this is a king asking a foreigner who's just come to town and bought a little piece of track of ground. Verse 9, intermarry with us, give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us, and the land will be open before you. Live and trade in it and acquire property in it. He says, you can be here together with us. We'll be one people. He says, just please let my son marry your daughter. Even Shechem pipes up now. His own personal interest. You'll hear it in verse 11 and 12. Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers. Now, how did they feel about him? Very angry. And so this is what Shechem is saying. I'm not so sure Shechem understands that they already know. It doesn't give that insight. But Shechem said to her father and to her brothers, if I find favor in your sight, what an introduction. If I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatever you say to me. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give according to you, according as you say to me, but give me the girl in marriage. What's he basically saying? You just tell me how much to write the check for. Except for it's not really in money. It's in a bridal price. It's in a gift. He says, you give me anything and I'll give it to you. You ask whatever you want. And this is the prince of the land. He said, just tell me what you want. Now, keep in mind, Dinah's brothers are very angry. And look at what they do. Verse 13. But Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. Because of Shechem's actions, they felt justified to be deceivers. Do we ever do that kind of thing? Do we ever go, because you haven't treated me right, then I have a right to deceive you or to do something that's not right? Sometimes people justify evil, don't they? And sometimes those people happen to be us. And I want you to notice that's not the right move. It doesn't honor God. It doesn't go after purity. Then, notice how it continues here. Verse 14. They said to them, in other words, Jacob's sons and perhaps Jacob, said to Shechem and to Hamor, he says, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. That'd be disgraceful if we let her marry somebody who's not circumcised. Remember what circumcision was really all about? It was a covenant promise that the descendants of Abraham would receive what? The promised land. Keep that in your mind. He says, for that would be a disgrace to us. Verse 15. Only on this condition will we consent to you. He says, there's only one way out where we would let her marry you. And remember, this is out of deceit. He says, if you will become like us and that every male of you be circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you and we will take your daughters for ourselves and we will live with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go. Can you appreciate our? How did these brothers see Dinah? Did they see her tenderly? They weren't at odds with Dinah. He said, she might as well be our daughter too. He says, if you won't be circumcised, he says, every male among you, he says, there's no way you're going to marry Dinah. Vindication. Verse 18. When a young man has a desire for a young woman, it is amazing what he will do. Verse 18. Now their words seemed reasonable to Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. Well, this sounds plausible to them. The young man did not delay to do the thing because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he was more respected than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city. I'm assuming this to be the gate of Shechem. He says, and spoke to the men of their city saying, what news, what a proclamation. You can only imagine the people in the city, what they're about to hear going, you did what? Verse 21, These men are friendly or peaceable with us. Therefore, let them live in the land and trade in it, for behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them. It's interesting he hasn't come around to the real point yet, isn't it? He says, only on this condition will the men consent to us to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Oh, this is what it's going to take for us to be one people? And then here's what they continue with, verse 23. Will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours? Only let us consent to them and they will live with us. We can have all these physical things. We can take it all for ourselves. This is the only thing we need to do. You notice that not once does he say anything about, oh, you know, because Shechem wants to marry Dinah. Amazing how that gets left out, isn't it? They take it back. Sure enough, verse 24, all who went out of the gate of his city, that's what makes me assume it's Shechem, listened to Hamor and to his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. Every single one of them said, that's what we'll do. And if you notice, Shechem is so ready for this to happen, it seems like immediately whenever he gets told this, he does it in such a quick fashion. He is not holding back in anything, which tells you a little something about either how much he's infatuated with Dinah or how much he loves her and how tenderly he's willing to talk to her for all these things. Then come verse 25 and 26. Now, it came about on the third day. Now, I'm going to step aside for a second. Anybody in here ever had surgery? Yeah, we got a bunch of us, right? Usually the third day is what? It is the most sore, painful day that you have after surgery, right? So out of all the times whenever you would be vulnerable as a man or a woman, the third day is it. And pretty much if you ever have surgery, just go ahead and count on it. The painkillers are going to be gone by then, unless you're still taking some. So if you ever wondered, and keep in mind, this is the book of Genesis. This is before all the medical research and journals and everything else. Pain comes the third day after surgery. Isn't that something? It's as if the one who inspires this book knows exactly how we were created and made, isn't it? Because that's exactly who inspired it. Now, back to the story. Now, it came about on the third day when they were in pain that two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, I mean, these are full-blooded brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male. You tell me they're just a little upset. When it says very angry, I think it gives you the idea about how angry they are. They set out just the two of them. It doesn't mention any of the other brothers being as part of this story. Simeon and Levi. And you know who the priests are going to be born out of? Levi. You think we're going to stand for something? Later on, Levi is going to be standing for purity too. Whenever all of a sudden one of the children of God is there in, even among the own tabernacle and doing things that are lewd and going, he's willing to put a spear right through them both and kill them both on the spot. Which tells you once again, okay, they're going to stand for purity. Here they are. Now, that's their descendants. He says, each took his sword and came upon the city unawares. In other words, they came in as if nothing was wrong, and then they killed every single man in the city. Every single man. Now, I want to show you that's not justice. I want to show you it's not justice. Look over at the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapter 18. Now, this is going to be written quite a ways later after the book of Genesis. Ezekiel chapter 18. And look down at verse 20. And this is why God takes vengeance, because we don't know when to stop. When you get caught up in anger, when you get caught up in bitterness, when you get caught up in jealousy, all of a sudden, you don't know where justice should even stop. Ezekiel's going to tell us where it should have. Ezekiel chapter 18, look at verse 20. The person who sins will die. Who had sinned in the story? Shechem. Did Hamor sin? No, not at least in that aspect. We don't know about the rest of his life. The person who sins will die. The son will not bear the punishment for the father's iniquity, nor will the father bear the punishment for the son's iniquity. So, should Hamor be dead? No, he shouldn't. He says, the righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself. And here is a statement we need to understand. If you've ever been wronged by somebody, you want to know where God stands about you taking it out on their children? He will stand opposed to you. Understand this thought. Maybe sometimes as parents, we look at the things that our children do and we go, I didn't train them to be that way. And you go, God says, I know. I didn't train my children to be that way either. And you realize, I'm not going to hold a parent accountable for their children after they leave home. Now, while you're parenting, you have some accountability. But you realize it here. He's saying, you don't just, if the children are rotten, don't assume the parents are that way. If the parents are rotten, don't assume the children are that way. God says, I deal with everybody on an individual basis. Now, come back to Genesis chapter 34. So, if Simeon and Levi had the instruction from Ezekiel, they would have known who to go after. If they would have killed Shechem and Shechem alone, that would have been right where God says things should be. But instead, how far did they go? They killed every single male in the city of Shechem. That means there's a lot of widows and a lot of orphans. Now, verse 26. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house, which tells you where she was, and went forth. Verse 27. Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city because they had defiled their sister. They felt justified in taking the whole city. It wasn't just enough to go, well, we've killed all the men, that's enough. They said, well, we'll take all their stuff too. See how far beyond justice this has gone? Now it's gone so far that it's not justice anymore. What is it now? Greed. It's sin. You're not walking with God. Then, verse 28, they took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field. And they captured, and looted all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, even all that was in the houses. All of a sudden they come in and they take all the wives. They take all the little children. And you go, this is why James chapter 1 talks about the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Because they are angry. But what do they completely miss? Righteousness. We better be careful with anger. They can take us to some terrible places that do not walk with God. Now, here's a little something else for you. We're not going to go read it. But in Deuteronomy 21, verses 10 through 14, there's actually laws about what to do whenever you take a beautiful, it actually says beautiful woman. It doesn't say any other kind of woman, but I'm going to assume it applies to all. He says, what do you do when you take a captive because the parents have been killed and you want to marry her? You can read about it in Deuteronomy 21. What you do is 30 days to mourn over her father and mother. She shaves her own head. She trims her nails. And then you wait 30 days. And understand at that point, then it says, you shall never be able to sell her for money if you take her as a wife. And you imagine over the course of time to go, I'll take care of you. There was even a law for that. You couldn't just say, I want you. There was actually a process of that. But come back here in Genesis 34. Now you see what's going on. The little ones, their wives. Verse 30. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household. He says, I hope you're satisfied. We're about to all get destroyed because of what you did. Now, once again, what has God already promised Jacob? I will take care of you. He says, I'm going to give this land to your descendants. And to go, doesn't trust God. And how many times are we in a similar fashion? We know the promises of God. They're written in our head, but they haven't quite affected the way we think. And yet at the same time, look at what Simeon and Levi say. And I can understand the statement, but it didn't take them to the right place. Verse 31. But they said, should he treat our sister as a harlot? He said, should Shechem treat our sister, Dinah, our dear sweet sister, like a harlot? Are you okay with that, Jacob? And I want you to notice, he doesn't give you a reply from Jacob. Here's something I want to share with you. What you sow is also what you're going to reap. Here they are, they've deceived Shechem, Hamer, the city of the people there in Shechem. And on the third day, whenever they're in pain, that's when Simeon and Levi come in and kill every male in the city. Later on in the book of Joshua, when God's people are taking over the promised land, there's a group of people who decide they're going to trick the Israelites. They're the people of Gibeon. And it just so happens, Gibeonites are also Hivites. And they come in and they act like they've come from a far off land. They have all these old worn out wine skins and their clothes and their sandals and everything else. And they say, we heard about how great you are. And so that's why we came. We've come all this way. And one of the people of God says, well, yeah, maybe you're just tricking us. And then all of a sudden they say, make a covenant with us for peace. And sure enough, they don't consult God. And they make a covenant with the Gibeonites, the Hivites. And sure enough, 3 days later, they figure out they've been tricked. And God says, you made a covenant, so you're going to have to honor it. And sure enough, they were there. And they stayed around for many, many years. And so here they were being deceptive. What does God allow? I'll let you be tricked too. And that's hundreds of years later. So keep that in mind. One final thing I want you to think about. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. It talks about the power of the blood of Christ to forgive sin. Sexual sin. Other things as well in terms of drunkenness and lewdness. And to go, the blood of Christ makes us whole. We all come from varied pasts. And we don't come from purity in terms of our whole life. And understand that the blood of Christ has washed us, justified us, and sanctified us. But then that same chapter in 1 Corinthians 6 goes on to say, flee from sexual immorality. And when he says flee, he means run. Run. If there's anything that can destroy our lives quickly, is any kind of sexual immorality. And I hope you see from these verses back in Genesis, God desires purity, especially what we see in Deuteronomy. All right. Next week, there'll be a scripture song service. So we'll be back together here for this class in December, but we'll be together next week as well. All right. Have a good week.